I'm Stuart Sheldon.
My name's Ron Rothberg.
30 years ago, I was on Wall Street. I was the youngest vice president at my fancy company, but that's not what I wanted to do.
After spending nearly 25 years in media, I knew things were changing, both in the industry and inside me.
Swan Dive shares the powerful stories of those who had the clarity and backbone to make a major life pivot to their vision.
I took a swan dive.
I have been an artist ever since, and it's the best choice I ever made.
Getting closer to who you really are. That's Swan Dive. Pei Vineyards and co-founder Andy Pei created something bold, unique, and totally revolutionary for the California wine industry. And one of the main drivers of their success was in the not knowing.
The naivete is really important. I teach entrepreneurship. One of the things I say is, you know, it's really important to not know everything that you're getting into, because otherwise you'd never do it. You'd think of all the reasons why this is not going to work out, how difficult it is. I decided to go to business school because I was like, I got to write a business plan. I got to start knowing what I'm getting into. And I remember doing my competitive strategy analysis for the wine business. Everything that tells you this is a very competitive, mature market and you should not enter was exactly this business.
Seeking fertile ground above the fog to create some of the most widely acclaimed wines in California. Pour a glass. Cheers. Here's to another edition of Swan Dive. From the Peacock and Park Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, and in Costa Rica at the Fancy Nasty Studios, welcome to another edition of Swan Dive, our ongoing art project with Stu Sheldon and Ron Rothberg. Hello, Stuart. It's a pleasure. It always is. And seeing that beautiful punem.
Thank you, brother. Pura vida to you, my dear friend. It has been a minute, although I'm still buzzing and tingly from George Clinton, our last guest, who, if you didn't listen to that, just stop right now and go listen to. Don't stop.
Hold on. Last night I'm watching Jeopardy, and George Clinton is an answer on Jeopardy. Okay, we have arrived.
Of course he is. I was going to say stop this and go listen to that first, but no. Listen to this, and as soon as you're done, go to the next one, George Clinton. But and all kidding aside, it's actually a good segue, because the thing I want to talk about right now, which I realize is kind of a theme that we haven't spoken about kind of overtly, but is the idea of achievement. And it's one thing to work hard and make an honest living and make good money and, you know, pay the bills. But at the end of the day, you haven't necessarily made anything. You haven't left anything behind as proof that you did anything. And then there's those people in the world that go work their asses off. And at the end of the day, there's something that they made and they achieved something, a product. That's one level of achievement. The other level is when you actually pioneer something and kind of create a new something that didn't exist before. And both of those ideas are relevant to our guests today. And so if you don't mind, Ron, I'm going to jump right in, because I'm super excited. Our guest today is Andy Pei. Andy Pei, full disclosure, is a very dear friend of mine that I love very much. And in the mid-90s, Andy Pei and his brother Nick set out to find land for the vineyard that they dreamt of creating. Eventually, they settled on a property in California's West Sonoma Coast, an old sheep farm and apple orchard. Here, the brothers, along with star winemaker and Nick's later wife, Vanessa Wong, built Pei Vineyards, 53 acres of vines with six different grapes, where they make elegant, refined wines that are an expression of the land on which they are grown. Land which, according to the New York Times, quote, offers distinctive qualities shown transparently in their wines, primarily complex polished Pinot Noirs, savory Syrahs, fresh intense Chardonnays, and smaller amounts of vibrant Rhone whites. Pei Vineyards won the San Francisco Chronicle's 2010 Winery of the Year, and for good reason. Andy's wines are now poured in the finest restaurants in America, and I have had the distinct pleasure to enjoy many a bottle. I've also spent countless days at the Misty Mountain Pei Vineyard and count Andy, as I said, as one of my best friends. Welcome to Swan Dive, amigo. So nice to have you.
Oh, thank you, Stu. Happy to be here. Thank you for the introduction. If you know, if this painting thing doesn't work out, I got some copyright work for you.
Well, hold that thought. One never knows. You know, I admire, I've watched, I mean, you and I met not too long, just a few years after you and your brother rode around in a pickup truck, looking for space in an as yet discovered sort of wine growing area. And so I've watched your journey for the lion's share of it. And I have really marveled and because it's so foreign to me. But you guys both are hardworking guys, work hard, play hard guys. And you're both quite cultured. You grew up in a cultured home in Cleveland. Your dad sang opera. Your mom was a fine cook. And so the culture of your house included eating well, eating food from all over the world, having wine on the table. Tell us about how growing up in a cultured environment such as that informed your life then and now.
It's a really good question, Stu, because I, as I've been thinking a little bit about my swan dive within the context of some of the other podcasts that you've made, I keep on coming back to how important my upbringing was. So I grew up in Cleveland Heights, suburb of east side of Cleveland. As you mentioned, my dad was an opera singer, ran the Cleveland Opera, started the Cleveland Opera just out of enthusiasm. He was a whiff and poof when he was younger, you know, in college he sang, but, you know, what do you know about opera? Not much. He and another guy started it in the early 70s. And then they just ran it and they just did it. And then they were doing major productions and Pavarotti was staying at our house and things of that nature. And my mom ran all the benefits that turned into a business where she started running PR and event planning for nonprofits. In any event, we grew up eating and drinking well at the table. We didn't really know it. We just ate what was put on the table. But, you know, my mom was flying in ingredients and running farmers markets before that was the cool thing.
So wow.
Back in the 70s, it was kind of like the first wave of the cool thing. You know, she was making her own granola. She might have sewn a few of her own dresses. Not too hardcore, but touching on it. So, you know, I mean, I went to a lot of opera. I was in an opera with my dad and went to a lot of modern dance because, let's be honest, I was a young boy and they don't wear a lot of clothes and they're really fit. And so, you know, that just was kind of part of the ethos, but I wasn't conscious of it. I was very much on that conveyor belt or that escalator, I guess, if you don't want to be more, you know, judgmental about it. Went to a good school, studied hard, played sports, got into a good college, you know, was well prepared for it. So it was a cakewalk. And then, you know, I was an English major because I liked to read, a religion minor because I thought Asian religions were cool. You know, Buddhism seemed to make sense to me, you know, fit into my stoner philosophy at the time. And, but then it was time to get a job. And I was like, I don't know, you know. And fortunately, where I went to school, people came and offered you jobs. And so somebody pulled me out of the computer center when I was studying for a final and they said, hey, what are you doing for corporate recruiting? And I'm like, hey, I have no idea what you're talking about. And so I went down to the career center and signed up for two interviews, which everybody gets, for two names that I recognized because they were commercial banks. And I got a job as a banker because I could talk myself into it. And, you know, you don't have to light things on fire, as you and I both know, Stu, to get a job in banking. Lived in Manhattan for a couple of years. And really, you know, to answer your question, it was just the self-confidence that my parents gave me, saying like, you can do whatever you want. Teachers in high school, I kind of saw myself as the jock who could get solid B's until I had a couple teachers who's, you know, in my romantic poetry class, who was like, you know, you're really smart and your analysis in this paper of this Wordsworth poem is really astute. Hmm. You know, think of yourself that way.
Right.
And I started thinking of myself as an intellectual and no doubt in high school as a pseudo intellectual. You know, I'm sure I was walking around with my romantic poetry book to be sure that the girls could see that it said romantic poetry on the outside.
The gift that you got from your parents seems to be that both of them shared a lot of enthusiasm. You used that word. Is that something that was in your house and infectious for you?
You know, not Really? I mean, my parents are, you know, my dad's no longer with me, but they'd be their late 80s, early 90s. And they're of a generation that was just before, you know, kind of that 50s generation. So they weren't super enthusiastic. They're, my mom in particular was very, very supportive, though. She was my buddy. She would take me anywhere. She would drive me to any game, swim practice, you name it, anywhere. It doesn't matter what time in the morning, you know, hockey in Parma at 5 a.m. So it's just very supported, you know, very lucky that way. And I think that was part of the, hey, you can do anything.
Yeah.
And when I pulled out of my car or pulled out of my driveway on my way to college, my dad got in one side, leaned into the window and said, study hard. My mom leaned to the other side and said, have a great time. Right. And that was pretty much the two forces. It was like, study hard and keep your eyes open and enjoy yourself. You know, meet lots of people.
So why don't we just, you've set the table so beautifully. Why don't we just keep it going? So now you're a banker, and I suspect you, like I did, woke up one day and said, like, this is not what I want to be when I grow up. So if that's correct, what happened next?
You know, as you're saying, Stu, I was living in the East Village, where not a lot of the people at the bank were living. My buddy was an acid jazz hip hop DJ, and we would party until 4 a.m. in Alphabet's, you know, in the avenues. And then I'd get up at 7 and go to my job. And I very much in the morning felt like I was dressing up in my actor's costume, putting on the tie, you know, putting on the blue shirt that would sweat out on the subway on the way there. And like, I just felt like I was playing a role, you know, like this is what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, it was not rocket science. I mean, I basically was putting together decks and pitch books and just pretending. And I was looking around at people who were 5 years older than me, 10 years, 20, and saying, do I want to do what they're doing? Do I, you know, they're not bad people. They're, you know, but am I, are we similar interests, et cetera? And I was like, this isn't it. I don't know what it is, but this isn't it. And yet I'd always been doing kind of what I'm supposed to do. Like, what is the next field for me to perform on as a person who's been told to, you know, work hard, perform well, you know, be a quote unquote success. And from Cleveland, if you're successful, you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're, you know, something of that nature. And I didn't know what my thing was. I was like, I don't know what it is. So to keep my brain fired up when I was working in banking, I was taking night classes in cultural anthropology and Tibetan Buddhism. That's kind of what was interesting. It's what I like to read. And I'd studied some cultural anthropology in college and thought it was pretty cool. So as I'm trying to figure out what's next, my brother-in-law, who is a banker, older than I am, and I start talking on vacation about Buddhism because he'd studied that in college. And he's like, you should check out the Asia Society on Park. And so I went to the Asia Society, and turns out this guy, Buddha Bob, was leading a tour around Kailash in Tibet. And he said, yeah, I'm taking a group. You should go. And I was like, yes, I should. So I gave notice. I, you know, 3 months notice, and gave up my apartment in the village, and waited for my books to arrive, and they never arrived. And eventually I got a hold of the Asia Society, and they're like, yeah, you should talk to Bob. I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, just talk to Bob. So Bob and I meet at a cafe. He's like, oh, yeah, my daughter loves this cafe in the village. This is Bob Thurman, Uma Thurman's father, turns out. He's a very famous, I think he's the first American Buddhist monk. Anyway, we meet there, and he's like, yeah, we canceled the trip. You know, welcome to the spontaneous life of the Buddhist. I was like, yeah. F you, buddy.
Was that, but that decision, you just said, he asked, you said yes, was no hesitation, no thought process behind it, just muscle memory, go.
Yeah, it was like I'd saved a little bit of money because I didn't really spend a lot of money living in the village. You know, I didn't make a ton. I mean, it was banking back in the early 90s. But I had a little bit of money, didn't know what I wanted to do, was interested in Buddhism. Here was this thing that was, again, pseudo-intellectual. I'd be with this Buddhist monk scholar who would take you around Kailash for 2.5 weeks, I think, giving instruction about what you're looking at in Buddhism and everything else. And then from there, I just backpacked until my money ran out. And you know, so instead, I that flight that stopped in Hawaii, I got off and spent 4 weeks with my buddies, my best friends from high school. And they were in the military there. I've rejiggered my schedule and ended up from there going into Southeast Asia and going and visiting some of these tribes that I'd studied. It just ended up then from there going up to Ladakh, northern India, and Nepal and staying in monasteries. And again, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just like, I'm just going to go check it out. And, you know, when I was in visiting the Wamena Valley, the Dani people, you know, that's not tourism land. That's like ornithologist, anthropologist. That's where one of the Rockefellers met his ending at the end of a fork. You know, it was interesting. It was a little bit like, what are you doing here? I was curious. I was interested. And I had really, you know, at another time, I'll tell you, like, amazing experiences getting ditched in the middle of the bush with no money and not knowing how to speak the language. But any event, I was just kind of doing and going and seeing what's next. And eventually I ran out of money and had to go home for Christmas. My parents flew you home and they said, what now? And I said, well, I don't have any money to fly back. So I guess I'll go to Berkeley because that's where people go when they run out of money from backpacking in Asia. And I'd studied when I was in Sulawesi in the Tarajan Highlands, I'd met a woman who studied her PhD research in the Tarajan Highlands and ended up meeting a guy there, a Tarajan guy, and married him and stayed. And she and I would talk every afternoon. And she was like, you should check out Berkeley. UC Berkeley has a department, a geography department, where they study economic development policy. That really seems to be what you're interested in, is how all these various cultures are experiencing industrialism and being integrated into Western economies. And so that's what, you know, that's why I went to Berkeley, really. I took those classes, and what they turned out to be was Marxist theory. And I was like, oof, Marxist theory is tough stuff to read. To make it make sense, you really got to do a lot of backflips, so many that I think you end up dizzy and don't know which way is up. And so, yeah, I'm reading, you know, living in a bungalow, reading, you know, What Color Is Your Parachute? And realizing that I love food, I love cooking. I'm in Berkeley. This is kind of, you know, one of the homes for California cuisine, or U.S. cuisine, but California cuisine, where Chez Panisse and all the farmers markets, and getting interested in jazz. And so I'm listening to jazz albums, cooking, and my brother, who's nearby, is coming up and visiting. And he's bringing wine, because he, after college, went, as my parents were saying, you know, go take your LSATs. He said, no, I'm going to go work at Schramsberg in the Napa Valley with my buddy Hugh, who went to Bowdoin with him. And Hugh's family had started Schramsberg, which is a sparkling wine producer of great repute. And he caught the bug, and he'd gone into wine. So he was down in Santa Cruz making wine at the time when I came out. And he would bring the wine. We would brew beer. I would cook. We'd listen to jazz. We'd stay up all night. And in those sessions, he was like, you should really check out wine. I was like, yeah, I think food's my thing. And so I started working in a restaurant just very casually. And a lady there who owned it was like, why do you want to be a chef? And I was like, man, I love going to the farmer's market, checking out ingredients, putting together an idea of a plan, buying a bunch of ingredients and cooking all day. She was like, that is nothing at all what it's like to be a professional chef. You know, it's holidays, it's weekends, you get off at 2 a.m, you crank out the same old dish, very little creativity until you're, you know, running your own kitchen. I was like, wow, well, that's not why I want to be a chef. I don't want to just crank away at some set product over and over. And so I had my brother in my ear. And so this was a little bit, I think, where, it wasn't so much a dive off a cliff as it was this is the next thing that occurs to me that I should go check out. And I don't know where it's going. But I went and worked a harvest up in Napa, living in a trailer. You know, I'm 25. I loved it. It was like game time. You know, everybody's hands on. It's 18-hour days plus. There are no days off. And everybody's excited and exhausted. And when that ended, I said, all right, well, I guess I should go find out what it's like to sell wine. and what people are thinking of when they buy wine. So I went and worked in the city as a retailer. And I took a job at a wine shop where, you know, I'm making minimum wage and I'm living with five other people in San Francisco. And that's when my head exploded. And that's when I was like, oh my God, wines from different regions taste different depending on the vintage, depending on those people's cultures and what they want to do. And what do I like? And I started figuring that out. And I was in three tasting groups a week, tasting a couple hundred wines a week as a buyer in the shop. And my brother's in my ear. And he's like, check it out. You know, we could do something. We could do this. And he's a couple years older than I am. He's 3.5 years older. And he had the production degree. He'd gone to Davis and gotten his master's in enology, which is winemaking chemistry, really, winemaking and viticulture, grape growing. And, he was definitely had thought about what I could do for him. He's like, you're the finance guy. You're the guy who just goes out and does things. You're, you know, the entrepreneurial minded. We could do this. And so we started traveling and we went up to Oregon. We went down to what's now Southern, you know, Santa Rita Hills in Southern California, and went up to the Walla Walla in Washington, Eastern Washington, and all over the place, looking for land. And the idea was really, you know, I liked European wine at the time. That's what I was drinking almost exclusively. That's what I was buying. And what I liked about it was that the people who, when you tasted the wine, you're like, I could tell that that's the Nebbiolo grape because it's aromatic and lifted and it's not obscured by this person trying to make it into something else by either picking it a certain way, making it a certain way, putting their fingerprint on it. They were trying to instead let the sight show. And, you know, that doesn't mean all the wines were delicious or elegant or harmonious, but they were very much themselves. Hmm. And as a person getting new to wine, getting interested in wine, being able to identify and be like, I know what that is. That was part of the excitement. It was like, yes, I'm like sharpening this tool, this my palate and my brain and my memory, sense memory. And that was a fun game. And I was doing, as I was saying, in tasting groups 3 days a week, you're doing all that tasting blind, not knowing what you're drinking. And it was kind of a fun game. At the same time, I'm developing, well, what do I like? And so as I'm talking to my brother, I'm like, I like wines that really show a sense of place and have a transparency to them. He was felt similarly. And so that's what led us on our journey that eventually ended up in our piece of land way out in a part of the West Sonoma Coast where no one had ever planted before.
Let me stop you there because I want to introduce another line from the New York Times, which says, quote, back in the mid 1990s, when the young Pei brothers, Andy's now 52 and Nick 56, decided they wanted to plant a vineyard and make wine, they were something of an anomaly. They had grown up in a suburb of Cleveland in a wine loving family, but Andy had no experience growing grapes or making wine. Nick at least had worked for a small winery that bought grapes from all over the Santa Cruz Mountains. Regarding that early quest to find a place for your vineyard, you said, we drove around in pickup trucks looking for rivers and low spots and other things that might indicate fog, like lichen and moss on fence posts and trees. Ferns would tell you water was trapped in soils, unquote. I read that again today. I read it when it came out a few years ago, but I thought to myself, moss on fence posts? This is so ridiculously romantic and so granularly aware. And as an artist, Andy, I see winemaking, and I always have since I've known you, as a unique and extremely complex collaborative mixed media installation. It's like this insane art project. And as far as I'm concerned, you're not only a Renaissance man, but an artist. And so you've brought us sort of to the promised land. And did you see this as a creative endeavor all the way? Did you view yourself through the prism of an artist?
Well, I mean, I definitely saw it through the prism of wanting to create something that was my own and right. Something that I could make and be proud of. In the introduction, you talked about that, Stu, and that was very much something I'd kind of learned as a banker that I, that the product that I was handing them, I didn't feel any kind of connection with or excitement about. It wasn't my own aesthetic. It wasn't something that, that, you know, what happened has happened with wine, with my wine, has become my identity. It's kind of who I am. I wouldn't know what, you know, to do. People all the time say, what if somebody were to, you know, give you $50 million and buy your vineyard and winery, what would you do? I'd say no thanks, because I would just have to go do it over all over again. And I'm 53. I'm tired. Right. I don't want to do it all over again. Yeah. And my vineyard 25 years from now would be when it's where it is now, at the right age, making the best wines it can make. And I'd be in my late 70s. It's like, no. I'm where I want to be. And this is who I am.
I appreciate that. I read somewhere that Nick said, quote, it was about pioneering terroir. And terroir is like the place that a wine grows, the minerals, the dirt. Pioneering terroir, creating something that was going to be new and different. And so few of us ever pioneer anything. You know, let's be real. But you guys really pioneered a space, because the land that you bought ended up becoming an appellation, a specifically designated area for wine growing based on the pioneering of the terroir, which you and your brother did in an old pickup truck looking for moss on the trees. Tell us what it's like now that you're 25 years in. What is it like to be actual pioneers?
You know, that AVA, that American Viticultural region that you were talking about, the West Sonoma Coast, very much was, and I think somewhat consciously, I don't want to totally admit it, but I think somewhat consciously was a desire to create something that would last. You know, our vineyard could go back to seed and, you know, 100 years from now could be something else. But that AVA will always exist. And the West Sonoma Coast AVA, we're in the northern part of it. There are other vineyards down south along the coast there and other pioneers of their subregions. But we were the very first people up in the north. And the reason why we had to be pioneers, or a couple reasons. One was the places under vine in the early 90s, mid 90s, weren't making the style of wines that we really wanted. They were directionally on the coast south of us in that direction, but we wanted more aromatic. We wanted more lift. We wanted more tea, earth, we wanted more floral notes, not just fruit. California in the 90s was known for making big fruit forward wines. They weren't necessarily elegant, aromatic, and transparent to sight. And we really were looking to get away from the sun, the beautiful California sun. We didn't want to fight it. And that's why we wanted to be down where we'd see, you know, some signs of fog, which would mitigate the temperatures, also add some moisture and be up against that Pacific Ocean, which is 50 degrees year round. And so that's why we went out to the coast. That's why we didn't end up in Oregon, which is more inland, or Walla Walla, which is way inland and warm. And we're down in Santa Maria Hills, where the water's warmer, so the days are warmer. We were up in the kind of the north coast of California, which is cold and really difficult to grow and really low yields and very expensive. And you really have to want to be there and feel like that's the only place where you can make the wines the way you want to make. Because otherwise, it's a fool's errand. It's very difficult to make money. It's very inconsistent as far as your yields, so therefore your production, therefore your finances. It's a tricky thing to do. So you're doing it because you have to. And then the terroir thing, I think, I'm going to continue to ramble. The terroir thing is interesting because terroir is not just the place, it's the people. Because the people decide where to plant, how to plant, when to pick, how to make it, and all those things which shape the fruit that you get. And people, we're a product of our culture, where we grew up, what we ate, what we listened to, you know, the degree that of the history of where we grew up. And so people are a really, really important part of terroir. And for us, I think because of the food we ate, I think of the confidence that our parents and our environment gave us just to go for it, led us to say, yeah, we could go up to where nobody's ever planted before. where people said it was too cold, too wet, definitely remote. My brother basically, when we were down in Santa Barbara looking for land before we found ours, we were going to buy this old horse ranch. And I was like, wow, Nick, it's an hour to the nearest like bar or girls. Like, and he said, don't worry about it. We're going to, if we choose the place for what's going to make the best wine, the rest will figure itself out. And when we got up to where we eventually bought our land on the West Sonoma coast, it's even more remote. And, you know, we were like, yeah, whatever. Well, the rest is going to figure itself out. And it has, but it's hasn't been necessarily easy. My brother lives out there by himself 4 to 5 days a week. He's got a family inland, you know, kids, wife, our winery, et cetera. Like I live down in Oakland. I drive a lot to the vineyard of the winery, 3 hours to get everywhere. So, but it's worked itself out. And so to go up there though, you know, didn't feel like we were doing anything crazy. It wasn't like, oh yeah, we're going to plant 30 acres, which, you know, we learned 10 years down the road. We're like, that was foolhardy, you know, to plant 30 acres all at once, making a gamble on a bunch of different clones and varieties, not really knowing what is going to do well out there, having some idea that, yeah, this is very cold climate, probably colder than anywhere else. So we're probably going to make wines that are going to have these different type of profile, but not really knowing, not just dipping your toe in. And that was kind of a head first.
You know, I want to speak to that because winemaking is not for the faint of heart as an investment. I've gleaned from watching you. You bought the land in 96, you planted it in 98, you made your first vintage in 2001 and sold it in 2003. So it takes 4 years from planting to producing fruit that you actually want to make. And then it's a couple years until you get the wine. And those early, I'll never forget. I was up at the farm 1 year for 4th of July, probably 20 years ago. And your brother walks by and he says, "Hey man, do you want to try a bottle of the first Chardonnay that we bottled?" It's like, it was unlabeled. It was not sellable, but it was like one of the very first batches of Chardonnay. I'm like, that's totally awesome. Of course I do. We drank it. It was good. Mixed words, you know, it's not going to be great, but the fact that you guys just like, you didn't know what you didn't know and call it naivete or youthful exuberance. But you just did it. And of course it worked out and thank God. But boy, you got to have some cojones to do that, man. You got to have big balls and be kind of dumb, big dogs running around in the field, but you did it.
Well, cause you were in wine sales. Well, you know how hard it is to sell. It's so competitive, man. There's a lot of bottles on the shelf.
Well, I mean, yeah, fortunately I was only in wine sales for like a year. So because I think the naivete is really important. I teach entrepreneurship every once in a while at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, where I got an MBA there. And one of the things I say is, you know, it's really important to not know everything that you're getting into, because otherwise you'd never do it.
Interesting.
You think of all the reasons why this is not going to work out, how difficult it is. And so after I bought the land and I decided to go to business school because I was like, I got to write a business plan. I got to start knowing what I'm getting into, at least from a financial perspective. And I remember doing my competitive strategy analysis for the wine business. And I was like, oh my God, everything that tells you this is a very competitive, mature market and you should not enter was exactly this business. Yeah. I was like, okay.
And looking back, you know, hindsight's 20/20, you got 25 years under your belt now. What would you do differently? Like, what was like just categorically wrong?
Yeah. I don't think we would plant 30 acres all at once. I think we probably plant like 10 and then, you know, 3 years later, another 10, but we planted 30 in 98, 18 in 01, and then the last 5 in 07 and 08. And so, you know, we did space it out a little bit, and at each planting, we refined it, different rootstock, different row orientation, some other things of that. But for the most part, you know, my brother's a really smart guy. You know, Nick, Stu, and he and I are pretty different, and that's actually really, really important.
Yeah.
And has been one of the reasons why I think we've not only been able to work well together, but be successful, is that we don't profess to know what the other person knows better than they do. And yeah. we've learned to trust one another. And that actually includes his wife, Vanessa, as the winemaker as well. We are all own in our own little worlds overlapping, but he is really, really bright and really sweats it.
For
and
sure.
has a very good work ethic, as you'd say, like the guy, you know, works his butt off. So, but half the time he's working on theories that, you know, just didn't turn out to be right, but, you know, they were considered. And so turns out the rootstocks that we planted on half of our first 30 acres were not good rootstocks for where we are. And so we've had to adjust and have to, in our farming, do things that we wouldn't necessarily want to do, but do because we have to, like water a little bit because they're not drought tolerant rootstocks. Turns out we're in California, doesn't rain in the summer.
Andy, I want to talk to you about collaboration because you were just hitting on it and your business is a true collaboration. There's basically three superheroes, each with their own lane. Nick is the grower. He's the farmer. He drives a tractor. He's wearing overalls and dirty fingernails. And he's, as you said, very good at what he does. He knows his stuff. Vanessa is the wunderkind winemaker who, you know, was the hot shot, kind of young. Wasn't she on the like under 30, like winemaker list of, you know, something or other back in the day? And
yeah, I'm a spectator. And I mean, you know, and yeah. she only worked for the best estates in the world. So like,
yeah, I mean, so she's yeah. a legend, you know, was a legend as a youngster. And you tell the story, you know, you are the bard and the face. And you said something incredibly compelling. Again, it may have been in the New York Times, but it is in one of the articles I read where you said, quote, "We don't over communicate. We all have our roles and we trust each other," unquote. That is a profound statement and a profound marker of a successful relationship, be it professional or personal. Tell us about the evolution and how you got to that place.
Well, so I love this question, Stu, because I think you know part of the evolution of this one. So, yeah, I mean, my brother's 3.5 years older than I am. He has the viticulture degree and we've just bought a piece of land. And yeah, I got my MBA. And then the day I graduated, he picked me up at the Greek Theater and drove me up in the pickup truck. And we literally, I hopped onto a skip steer loader and started creating French drains that afternoon. And we started planting our vineyard. But I was just the dumb labor. You know, yeah, I had an MBA, but that's not what we're doing. What we're doing is planting a vineyard. So I got my older brother who knows more than I am telling me what to do all the time. And that went on for about a year. And he went and worked a harvest at a vineyard down the ridge. And during the day, I'd be by myself on my tractor spreading seed and putting down straw and stuff like that, getting ready for the winter rains. And I was doing a couple of rows and I'm like, I feel like a character in a Steinbeck novel. And I do another row and I'm like, ah, those characters in Steinbeck novels are these bitter old men who wed themselves to a godforsaken rock and like become just bitter. I was like, that's not me. I mean, I'm a social person. I get energy from people. I'm not sure I can do this. And so when Nick came back a couple weeks later from working harvest, I was like, I got to go get to the city. I need to make a little bit of money to dump into this hole. I got to go meet someone and, you know, hopefully get married and all that. To my brother's credit, he was like, I got this. This is really just a one-person job at this point, you know, other than some laborers and stuff like that. So then I was able to go off. I got another job, made some money a while. And I was like, okay, I'm going to come back when I've got wine to sell. And as I was coming back, you know, I'm calling my brother all the time whenever any weather events happening. I'm like, oh my God, it's supposed to rain. Like, what are you doing? And he would, you know, talk about what he's doing. Sometimes he'd have a little bit of a tone like, dude, I got this. You go do your life down there and make money. I'm up here farming, you know, running our farm. And there were some points of contention. And, you know, especially when we'd have some, you know, when I came back in full time in 03, 04, we'd have some like really big weather events. You know, and I'm calling up panicked and I'm like, oh my God, Nick, oh my God. And he talked me through it. And then, you know, we'd kind of get in each other's business a little bit. You know, I was getting in his business, basically. Yeah. And I was learning to trust him and seeing that he did know what he was doing and that he did know he was thinking this through. I was like, okay, he's got this. And I backed off. Yeah. And really what helped that was when Vanessa came in 01, because she kicked Nick full time into the vineyard because she's the hotshot winemaker.
Hmm. Right.
She started making the wine. Nick would kind of be like, you know, obviously they live together. They're married. They talk about the wine all the time, but really it's, she's running the show.
Sure. You know, that had hustling. That had potential to be a Yoko Ono situation too, huh?
For sure. Yeah. Fortunately, Vanessa and I kind of see wine very similarly. In fact, all three of us do, fortunately. There isn't one of us who's like, dude, I want to make huge, you know, over the top, in your face wine. She's very much a person of restraint, and didn't have to be that way. My brother, you know, they actually, we hired her and she worked for us before they started dating and getting married.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's a fun fact. I thought she was kind of part of the deal, a package deal kind of going in.
Well, I mean, you know, okay, things get more complicated as the deeper, the more you peel the onion. Right. But basically, she was putting in a vineyard for Peter Michael, where she was winemaker south of us. Heard about these two guys up north, ponytails, middle of nowhere, planted a bunch of Pinot. She visited. She knew Nick a little bit because she went to Davis undergrad when he was there at grad school. And, you know, she tasted a little bit of Chardonnay that was that 2000 that you tasted, that third leaf Chardonnay. She tasted on the vine in September, and she's like, whoa, this tastes like Chardonnay. That I've never tasted Chardonnay like this.
That was the moment right there.
Hmm.
And so they got talking. And so by the spring of 2001, she's like, yeah, I want to make your wines. Yeah. And my brother's like, oh, okay. You know, and so she left Peter Michael and became her winemaker, and they started dating just about the same time. And then 01 was our harvest. And, you know, they got married in, I think, 02 or 03.
So I want to interject here. I want to remind everyone, because this wine is sublime. It's special. It's glorious. It's restrained. It's funny that Andy opened earlier on talking about like pursuing Buddhist thought and Buddhist teachings. And so much of the personality of the wine has that kind of lovely restraint to it. It's funny too, Andy, because you know you're the least Buddhist of the three of you. I mean, you're the one studying Buddhism, and these guys are just Buddha. They're Buddhas. I mean, I'm kidding, of course.
Well, no, but I actually think that, you know, you were asking that question before, Ron. I mean, I think people who are attracted to Buddhism oftentimes are people who need more Buddhism.
Yeah, exactly, man. Exactly.
I'm a high stress, not necessarily the most patient person. That's what I find very appealing about, you know, act without acting and these types of things. That's what interests me.
But I also think too, that people who have walked the path of success often lay those tracks and go back to their roots in many respects. And that was something that was planted in you early on, clearly. So that is something that, you know, if people are trying to figure it out, you know, go back to those first things that really lit you up and it'll lead you on that path.
Yeah. And the restraint that you're talking about in the wine stew fits into what Ron's saying. Like it's, you know, it's way easier to make big, bold statements, you know, in whatever, in wine, just, you know, pick ripe, add a bunch of oak, wham. People are like, whoa, when they take a sip. You know, that's just all impact. There's no nuance. There's no story there. There's no narrative. There's no emotional experience. I don't want to engage just your belly. I want to engage your brain with the wine as well.
Yeah. And well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think that's what creates a conversation and an experience for someone. And I want to create something that when people drink it, are adding something to their lives. I'm not saving lives. Right? Yeah, you know, right, I'm not like not changing the world in any way, but I'm hopefully deepening a sensory experience for somebody and connecting them to things in their life. Because one of the really cool things about wine is that smell is attached to your brain and to memories, just like sound. And so when you drink wine, all these things are flooding your brain, all these memories and emotions and things. And that is valuable. And that's one of the reasons why I love why.
Well, you're bringing us back full circle, because at the top I talked about achievement, and I talked about this idea of making something that wasn't there before. We've had a lot of guests on the show, and everyone's story is profound. You're one of the guests who has unequivocally made things and made something that wasn't there before, and in fact pioneered something. How do you, how do you look at your achievement? And two-part question, and do you feel you've achieved something? And if so, what have you achieved? And what more do you wish to achieve?
Wow. So, this ties into Buddhism. So my ego, ego is an interesting thing. Getting into my 40s, early 40s, I started having kids. And, before kids, I was running really hard selling wine, wanting everybody to know about my wine, to taste my wine, to appreciate it, to see that it's different and that it's, it's got something to say of merit and all of that. And that was my focus. And I was really busting for it. And then as my kids were starting to grow a little bit and I was traveling a lot, and I was like, I don't want to miss out on my kids. I don't want to miss out on that experience and with my wife. And I took my foot off the pedal a little bit on the travel. I was still as competitive as ever, as egotistical as ever, and wanting to push that. But realizing that you have to sacrifice everything in life is a sacrifice. It's not a sacrifice. It's an exchange. And maybe more people would know about pay, and people would think that, it'd be more highly regarded and et cetera. But at what cost, to me, being able to instead have relationships with my children and have them know me and have a wife that still likes me. Mm-hmm. And so when you ask what's next? My kids are now in early teenagers. And as they're, in the next 5 to 7 years going to be fading out of my daily life and very much getting into their own. I'm thinking a lot more about legacy, and really just for my own, what do I want to do with the next 30 to 40 years? And what have I not done with pay that I'd like to do? And if it's not pay, what? Mm. And with the wines, I feel like we're making our best wines ever. And that's not surprising. The vineyard's in its fighting ages. As the vines get older, they can make more complex, nuance-driven wines as the root systems get fully developed, et cetera. There are a lot of challenges with weather that we're facing. Those keep actually things quite interesting, not necessarily always awesome. Fires, extreme weather is not a farmer's friend. But those are interesting challenges. But really the challenge is for me to get pay established as a winery that people, when they think about the West Sonoma Coast, they think about a certain style, they think, right, pay. And I feel like we're on that road, but I'd like to get it there so that I then can not always be the guy pushing the rock up the hill. And it can just run.
So Stu's question was about achievement, and your answer was that balance, it seems, between achievement and appreciation. Would you, as your children are a big part of your life and as they get older, having that balance, because you've achieved a lot, and now that dialing of the dial to appreciate what you've done, does that have any relevance to where you're at right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's because my idea of achievement is broadening to include being a good father and being a good husband and just being a good person in my community. I do a lot more volunteer work and board work and trying to make space for that. I do feel like we've achieved something with the wine. I think we're making good wines that have a reason for being. And I'd like that to continue, but I also would like to to achieve in all these other ways as well.
Let me ask you this. It's a slightly different trajectory, but how do you define success, and are you successful?
Yeah. I don't think success is a static thing. I don't think you get somewhere and you're like, I am a success. I think it's a process, and I think it's always changing. Like, yeah, you asked that question because I've said my idea of achievement has broadened. So my idea of success has broadened. Success to me would be, you know, having my boys like me and want to spend time with me.
Here, here, me too.
You know, when I get older, if my kids call me up and like, hey, Dad, how you doing? Okay, I've succeeded in being a dad.
Big.
You know, and as far as wine, it is love. It is really, you know, I'll be honest, it's great when people are like, hey, I really like your wine. Like, I go down to the cellar and I pick it and I'm excited to have it. And thank you. And I'm like, that feels good. I won't lie. You know, I mean, that is not really what's the most important thing to me right now anymore. Right. The most important thing to me is it's just being multidimensional and trying to be a good person, and a good father and being responsible for my business as well.
You've had a good gut, Andy. You got a good gut. You got a good nose. You got a good palate, but you got a good gut too. You got a good internal, an internal sort of vectoring system. And I appreciate that about you. And you are now, 25 years into this profound experiment, which is a very successful experiment on many, many levels. Not the least of which is that the wine is exquisite. But you've managed to do it with family. You've been a placemaker, and I've been to that place. It's magical. I've been there as a single adult partying into the wee hours, watching the sunrise. And I've been there as a parent sleeping in a tent with my babies. And I've watched what you've built, and it's extraordinary. And I'm so excited, you know, for whatever comes next. But I will say this, that from my vantage point, you are a beautiful success as a human being. You're kind-hearted, you're thoughtful, you're honest, you're forthright. You work hard, you play harder, and that's as it should be. It's just a pleasure to call you a friend, and I'm so glad that you've joined us here. And with that, you know, this is where we get to kind of let you say, give a shout out to the world, tell people how to learn more, where to find you, and how to buy that beautiful nectar that you make. So I'm going to give it to you and let you say anything that you would like to say.
Oh, well, all right. Well, thank you. So Pay Vineyards. We can be found online at PEAY Vineyards with an S.com. I'd love it if you're curious. We make wine at all different types of price points, mostly Pinot Noir, a little bit of Syrah and Chardonnay, and a touch of Viognier. I don't know, wherever you live, we tend to be in fine dining. We don't do a lot of retail. So online on our website is probably the best place to find Pay Wines.
Yeah. And if you want to get, you know, you want your girlfriend to really like you, or your boyfriend or your husband or your wife, you just order a bottle of this, or better yet, a case, and you're welcome. That's all I'm going to say. Get some Pinot Noir from these guys, and trust me.
There you go. From the top of the mountain. I love it.
Wow, man. Well, that was fun. Well, you know, here we are, ladies and gentlemen, another amazing edition of Swan Dive with an incredible swan dive into the incredibly arcane and wonderful world of winemaking. I can't imagine, you know, a more interesting journey than you guys and driving around in a pickup truck looking for lichen. But
lift your glass and cheers to that one. Yeah,
that's what really happened. So Andy Pay, I love you very much, brother, and thank you for sharing some time with us on Swan Dive.
Well, thanks so much for having me, boys.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Swan Dive. If you like what you heard, please rate, review, and share this episode. Also, we are building a new season of Swan Dive. So if you or you know someone who has experienced a swan dive in their life, please hit us up and contact us through our website, www.swandive.us.